Thai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, thank you. You're back with Michael Bagram every Tuesday morning between 10 and 11. I started introducing our guest, Advocate Lynette Myberg. Advocate Myberg is with us this morning, and I thank her for giving up of her time. But Lynette, please let us go through a little bit of your early history, school, where were you brought up, and basically what led you into law?
I was brought up in what is now the Northwest, Rustenburg and Brits. And I became a lawyer. I studied law because my father wanted me to study medicine, and I was a bit of a rebellious child.
Well, there you are.
I think it was reverse psychology, because it was obviously the right choice.
Yeah. And which school did you go to? Were you in the Northwest? Did you school up there? Yes. Or?
There was one high school in Brits. It's a small tobacco town, about 60 kilometers outside of Pretoria. So we all went there. We didn't have any choices.
Okay. And then after school, did you go straight on to university?
Yes.
And registered for law there? And you'll see the CV says that you first went to the University of Pretoria and then you moved to the University of the Free State.
I did, yes.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, variety is the spice of life, you know.
Of course.
So I graduated in Pretoria. In the meantime, my folks had relocated to Bloemfontein and they talked me into going there to do my LLB. And it's one of the best legal faculties in South Africa, I believe. So I was very happy to go and do my LLB there.
Okay. And then what led you into going to work for the Department of Justice?
Well, this is a strange thing because when I graduated, I never considered doing anything other than that. It never once crossed my mind to do anything else. So many people discouraged me and told me it's a man's job and it's rough and it's difficult. But that was like a siren calling to me. I moved to Cape Town without having a job, a post, and within a week of arriving here, I got a phone call asking me to start at Kells River Court. That's meant to be.
Okay. I mean, I know that my colleague in Parliament followed a similar sort of path, Glynis Breitenbacher. I don't know, I presume you know Glynis.
He was very friendly with my husband when we were all at QFS, yes.
Okay, and she decided as well to go work for the Department of Justice and follow a very similar path. And interesting, in fact, I have a brother-in-law, Michael Crowe, that did exactly the same thing. He went to go and work for the Department of Justice in Grahamstown. So despite me thinking that people don't go work there, I now know three of you that all went to the Department of Justice. What brought you into the Sexual Offences Court, which is a specialty on its own?
It is back then, up until then, until the early 90s, it was, I suppose it still is, it's the kind of crime that nobody wants to prosecute because typically it's very difficult, it's very emotional, conviction rates are terrible. And for some reason, it kind of just fell on me and I found that I did quite well with it. Then Frank Kahn, who was the Attorney General at the time, the Director of Public Prosecutions here in Cape Town, decided that because the conviction rate looked so terrible, we needed a specialist court. And myself and a colleague were invited to start this court in Wynberg. And in fact, I must tell you that our conviction rate went up from below 50%, which is the average, to about 83% in the time that we ran that specialist court. And it was really difficult, but I think perhaps some of the best work I've done in my career.
What is happening now in that? There are all sorts of problems in that, and I've been watching the press on this, One of my colleagues in Parliament has noted that in most of the police stations around the country, there are very little test kits. And in fact, the dockets are completely illegible. And without a decent police record out and decent docket, I don't know what it was like in your day when you were in that sexual offences court. That was in 93 to 96. But apparently now it's absolutely shocking. I don't know if you've ever watched or seen what's going on now and maybe kept an interest in those courts. But I mean, I presume the dockets you received to get to that high level of conviction rate were decent dockets and you could get decent witnesses and that sort of thing.
I think what made the difference back then is we had resources. So we would get a docket, and investigating officers would come in to us with their dockets, and we would direct the investigation. We would help the police and steer them in a direction so that we got all the information we needed, firstly. And secondly, because we had resources, we had time to sit and prep witnesses and make sure that we had everything we needed. And if there are no resources and if there is no will, this is never going to work. Even in the police stations, there were staff allocated specifically to sexual offences. There were facilities. There was always someone there ready and willing to do this. And without those resources, it's never ever going to be successful.
Well, my recall at the time, and I knew the director Frank Kahn, who ran a very, very clean ship and made sure that it was steered in the right direction. And Prosecutor Kahn was probably the lead protocol that was happening. It probably made sure that all of you actually did a proper job, and that seems to be missing today.
He did. He put a lot of pressure on us to do things right, and gave us the resources to do it. And that will to do that kind of thing seems to have, I don't know, thinned out on the ground a bit, maybe. It's a hard thing to do.
I understand that, and it's desperately needed, especially in South Africa today. I remember a colleague of mine and a friend of mine, Petrus Mere, who was working in Frank Kahn's office. I don't know if you ever met him, but I remember him explaining to me that it was a constant battle to make sure that the police and the prosecutors worked hand in glove, and that was what made it so useful in those days and so successful. You want to comment on what's happening today and the figures that we're getting less than 10% conviction?
That is not only shocking, it is a symptom of disinterest. It's a symptom of people not being invested in what they're doing. I mean, it becomes a job instead of becoming something that is a calling. And one doesn't invest in it properly. That's when you lose the convictions because you simply don't have what you need to do that. It really takes commitment and dedication.
And because of that low conviction rate, and because the message has gone out to the public, many women, after having been raped or sexually molested, unfortunately don't even report this to police because they think it's just going to fall apart and they'll get somehow pilloried afterwards. It seems to have spread into the communities where people don't even come forward. So we don't even know the true rape numbers anymore. It's just a very sad situation. You want to comment on that?
It always was a problem, but I
Just before you
think.
comment, sorry, can I hold you? We're going to quickly pay the bills.
What if someone you love stopped breathing? In that moment, there's no time to wait, only time to act. Family and Friends CPR course at the Hatsola Training Center. Go to hatsola.co.za and book your course today. Hatsola, a moment of learning, a lifetime of living.
Handmade and healthy, it's how good food should be. not mass-produced from a huge factory. Gluten and egg-free, but packed with taste and love. It's Baba Char's salad dressing, and it's a cut above.
Make every meal special with Baba Char's salad dressing. Available at all kosher outlets.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, thank you. You're back with Michael Bagram between 10 and 11 every Tuesday morning, and I appreciate it. We are here with Advocate Lynette Myberg, who is taking us through some of her history, and we were talking about her time at this sexual offences court and the success that they had and the problems that we're experiencing today. And I know that a colleague of mine in Parliament has been going from police station to police station across the country as part of his oversight duty to show how the sexual offences don't get reported, the policemen mess it up, they don't have the test kits, they don't have the time. It's become a deluge, and it led to the courts probably getting less than 10% success rate in convicting people for sexual offences. And Advocate Myberg has been taking us through some of the history and some of the reasons why. I'm going to move on, if you don't mind, to your time with the Scorpions. You'd at that point, Lynette, and you had already met up and I think married Murray Zimbler at the time. Am I correct? When did that marriage take place?
In 94.
Okay, so at least you remember. I was gonna report you to Murray Zimbler on that. Murray is also a lawyer and a lecturer and a good friend of mine. But you then went and worked with the DSO, then known as the Scorpions. Tell us a bit about that journey.
So that was right at the beginning when it started. You'll remember that the first head of the DSO was Percy Son.
Yes.
He walked into my office one day at Rwanda Court and he invited me to join. And I thought very long and very hard about this. And in the end decided to go. There were four of us and Percy, and we had some really, really good investigators. And I decided that maybe this is the next thing that I should try out. And I was there. I ended up being there for 2 years. And that was really the very start of the development of racketeering charges in South Africa. And it was fascinating and very, very, very different. Not something that one can do long term when you have a family.
Yeah, I understand that, because you become almost married to that sort of job. And when you're talking about organized crime, you're talking about people who can have access to fancy lawyers, to evidence, to hide things, to basically cover everything up. It's an incredibly difficult job. But the Scorpions, as we all know, did absolutely fantastic work. Their success was trumpeted around the world at the time, so much so that a lot of the organized crime was in government, and let's call a spade a spade. Yep. We've seen a lot of that come out now with Zondo Commission and subsequent commissions, and a lot of the organized crime was within the police force as well. And because you were so successful at the Scorpions, from what I understand, is that they then moved to disband the Scorpions as quickly as possible. Do you remember that period in our history?
Yeah, I do. And Percy's son was absolutely adamant that he was going to have a clean unit. So much so that every 6 months he would polygraph his entire staff to make sure that everybody stayed honest. And if you don't have a clean unit, it's not going to have success. And I believe that's the reason why it didn't last.
Well, it was, to my mind, and I probably coupled with what you're saying, but the politicians were very unhappy on the success of the Scorpions, so much so at that point, there was a very strong move in Parliament to completely disband it, and also within the police, the general police force.
The interesting thing is that the one politician that really supported the unit was the then Minister of Justice. For the life of me, I can't remember who it was. I remember he had a crystal scorpion on his desk at Parliament, and he was very, very proud of this unit. And once he moved out, that's when things changed. But that was the major support for the unit, the one good Minister of Justice.
We have had a guest on the show, Advocate Paul Hoffman, who has been singing the praises of scorpions ever since, and has, in fact, run court cases. The Glenister, there were, I think, three different Glenister court cases against government, calling on government to actually go back to a unit that would have no fear or not do anything for favour. He believes that it left a large gap in our system. What's your belief on this? We've got the hawks now, but they're unfortunately answerable to the police.
Yeah, if it's not an entirely independent unit who's answerable to no one, then it's never going to work. And I don't see any way of addressing racketeering, corruption, and organized crime in South Africa without a completely independent unit. It's an absolute necessity.
Yeah, and he's still almost tilting at windmills, unfortunately, in that his campaign to try and get an organization again, like the Scorpions, back on the road. He is getting somewhere. You might have seen that MP Glenis Breytenbach has put forward a bill, an independent bill, to bring something back like the Scorpions and to try and get back to where we were. Where we actually had an independent unit. I don't know if you've seen those bills or heard about
I haven't, no, I have to confess. I would like to have a look at it, though. It would be
Okay, well,
interesting.
I will send you a copy after this program. It's interesting, but it's trying to get back to the former glory of the Scorpions. You then started also part-time. You were lecturing and then went and became an independent advocate. And what led you into the private sector, as it were?
The birth of my youngest child, like I said. What I was doing then was not particularly good for family life. So I then decided that I needed to be more available, and I was for all the time that my children were at school. And private practice seemed to be the thing. And I kind of accidentally fell into labor law when somebody asked me to go help them out with a matter at the CCMA. I'd never been there. And had so much fun that I've been there ever since. Well,
Well,
in another
yes.
term.
Well, since about 2002, we've been working together on and off, in that I've been briefing you, and colleagues of mine in my firm have been briefing you, and we've actually had probably 99% success. I publicly thank you for that. But
Thank you.
tell us a bit about that, your appearances at the CCMA, your preparation, how does it work? A little bit about it. Thanks.
The CCMA is meant to be accessible for people without legal representation. But it doesn't always work like that, especially when you're dealing with employees who are up against big companies who employ lawyers, who employ HR specialists. And then sometimes, unfortunately, it's necessary for lawyers to get involved. But the idea behind the CCMA, and I believe it's a good idea, is to make justice accessible for people who have nothing and who know nothing. And I think that apart from the fact that the CCMA lost so much of its funding, it has largely been very successful. I remember when one would refer a matter to the CCMA and within 3 weeks would be running an arbitration. But with the lack of funding now, we're waiting sometimes a year to run an arbitration, and that's almost as bad as it is in the labor court, and that is something which I think is not acceptable.
Well, let me fill you in. I mean, the funding of the CCMA comes obviously via the Department of Employment and Labour. The Labour Court is separate in that the funding for the Labour Court comes through the Department of Justice, and they've been throttled to a large degree as well. But what has happened is over the last 5 years, each year they're getting less and less funding. That's the CCMA, the Commission for Conciliation, Mediation and Arbitration, which is supposed to be a body set up through the Labour Relations Act, supposed to be a body that gives quick and easy justice, that would be accessible at no cost, that it would be quick, and that the returns on that would keep labour peace in the workplace. That's the ideals of it, and I think we do need to praise the early draft people of that. It was Cheadle and Thompson, the two early draftsmen of that piece of legislation. And also when I travel around the world, people are very jealous of our system and how it works. The CCMA in those early days, you might recall, used to boast that they settled. In other words, disputes came to a settlement before it went to arbitration of over 75%.
Yes.
Do you want to comment on that and that and the labor peace that broke out in the country?
Well, I think that the CCMA largely achieved its goal until about 2019. And I think, I don't know what happened, but that's when it started losing funding. But the commissioners were incredibly well trained, were really skilled at mediating, and more often than not, matters would settle. And that is the best outcome for everybody, because one should not waste time and money arbitrating when it should be a peacekeeping and peacemaking organ of state, and that it used to be.
Well, yes, I understand that. And look, there's still some very good commissioners. There's some commissioners that give very decent ruling. But it's a different skill altogether to be a mediator, a very different skill. I for one, couldn't do that. I'm a litigious sort of person. I couldn't really be. I haven't got the patience. But I've just been through a case now where the reality was that there was no chance of this being settled, but we had a really skilled mediator that somehow bumped our heads together and basically was the epitome of Henry Kissinger and pulled the rabbit out of the hat, and we had a settlement, which both of us were pretty shocked. I always say that a good settlement is, and we all repeat this, a bad settlement is better than a good judgment, because then someone walks out having lost and someone's won, and that might lead on to the labor court eventually or whatever. The other thing is, another phrase that I'll also try and use with my clients is that a good settlement is when both people leave crying, both sides leave crying, and that no one's happy, because the minute someone's too happy, then you've got someone that's very unhappy. Has that been your experience? I know you've been involved very strongly in the settlement of these cases long before we even get to the CCMA. It's one of your enormous skills, if I may say. Tell us a bit about that.
I think that the best outcome for clients is always a settlement, because it is something that they may not necessarily like, but they can live with. Whereas if you have an award or a judgment that goes against you, you can't live with it. And then invariably it gets challenged and it goes on review, and then it becomes protracted and expensive litigation in the labor court. I think mediation is something which is underutilized in our law system, not only in labor, but everywhere. And that every matter before it comes before judges or magistrates should first go to mediation, because that will not only leave more happy people, but will relieve a lot of the pressure on our justice system dealing with all the cases that we have to process.
Well, your thoughts on And clearly, I look like I'm agreeing with your thoughts, but your thoughts on the conciliation phase, which then leads to arbitration, is the conciliation. Conciliation is mediation. It's just a different word for it. That leads then to a settlement, which they still, funnily enough, I think last year's figures, 2025 figures from the CCMA, got 76% settlement. So it's still pretty good because the majority of cases are dismissal cases and individual dismissal cases. So if you look at that and you look at the conciliation then leading on to arbitration, that whole system, in your mind, do you think it's been working? Do you think it's a valuable? Conciliation was brought in long before any other justice system in labor or in the world. We were the first people to look at that.
If it wasn't for that, I don't think that the CCMA would have managed at all. If I'm not mistaken, we get about 30,000 referrals just in Cape Town every year. Now, it is absolutely impossible to process 30,000 cases. I think that the aim is to try and settle about 90% of cases. So if one gets over 75%, it's good. But without that, the system will break. It can't deal with the number of referrals that there are.
Well, if we compare that to what's happening in the High Court across the country, where people are sometimes waiting up to 4 or 5 years for their cases to be heard, one of the judges in the Gauteng division, I think Justice Malumbo in the Gauteng High Court, has tried to introduce a mediation process before any case is heard, and he's being attacked by some of the people in the profession and being attacked by some of the litigators. And he's trying desperately. Now, Justice Malumbo comes from a background of the Labour Court, who was very much in favour of ensuring that system would work. In other words, the CONARB, the lawyers called it, but conciliation first and then arbitration. It doesn't seem to be getting traction in the High Court. Have you got any comments on that?
I think that's about perception, because when a judge steps into the arena, so to speak, to try and get the parties to settle, then sometimes it creates the appearance of the judge forming a view. So I think it will only work if the judge who is conciliating or mediating is not the same, is not the trial judge. Then I think it will work really well. But lawyers are very quick to perceive bias from the bench and to say, no, you formed a view, you can't hear this matter. And I think that's the resistance. We need to change mindsets, we need to change people, train people to do it, and we need to have dedicated judges who only do mediations or conciliations, who aren't trial judges, because then it will take away the perception of bias.
I probably would. I know that I have, when I go into the CCMA and we've tried the conciliation, we haven't settled, we're about to start an arbitration, the commissioner is still, even at that point, at the dying point of the possibility of settlement, they do say, can we try to move back to the conciliation? And the rules allow that, to wear a hat again, obviously with the consent of the parties, to wear a hat again as a conciliator. They do ask, and when they do ask, they basically say, can I have permission to enter into that arena? And even then, at that point, they then separate the parties and try and talk to them individually. Now, some commissioners don't like that. Some do it. And me as a lawyer, I sometimes get pretty, I get that feeling of bias when you're quite right when you say it. There is a feeling. And so it's really difficult at that point to try and settle it. But they still do, because when parties are, you get cold feet. You're just about to go into an arbitration. It's a win or lose. There, the arbitration isn't a win-win. Never is. It's a win or lose. And at that point, you want to try again, but you're nervous. And your comments on that?
It could only work if you don't discuss the merits of the claim. So if we're only talking about how much money is going to settle this, I think it's fine. Going into the merits is going to create the perception of bias, and that should be off limits.
Well, okay, we're going to quickly pay the bills.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Hi, you're back with Michael Bagram every Tuesday morning between 10 and 11. Please do pop in and say hello to us and on our program. And let me have some feedback as to who you'd like to hear, who you'd like me to bring. I have access to some interesting people, and we have Advocate Lynette Myberg, who is practicing. She does a lot of labor work, and hence my involvement with her. And she's been going through her history from her public prosecution days with the Department of Justice in the Sexual Offences Court, and then a senior prosecutor at the Weinberg Court, and eventually working with the Scorpions. But when she became a mommy, she moved across to become a practicing advocate, and for very happy days with me, because we've been briefing Advocate Myberg in the Labor Court, in the CCMA, in bargaining councils. We've worked together in disciplinary hearings and grievance issues, the whole bit, the whole ambit of our labor law. And she has taken us through some of that history. Advocate Myberg, when you given a set of papers from the attorneys, and it's interesting because I work with a few advocates and they all approach it slightly differently, but I know that you insist on seeing every single page and then rearranging my file, as it were. Tell me a bit about that.
There's something about getting a file and really understanding the issues and really looking for what is it that we need to focus on. Where is our defense? Where is our point of attack? And unfortunately, the logic in my mind means that I have to take documents out and put them in piles and in the right order and compare them with each other. But only once you've read every single word on every single page does a penny drop and say, that is the avenue that we need to take. So that's how I arrived.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, because in fact, what I thought, and we've seen this recently with you, is that you get this massive file of basically a computer full of papers, and somehow you then find a golden thread and say, hold on, there's an easy way out of this. We don't need to have worry about any of it. We can raise one point and it kills the matter. You seem to be an expert in that. Maybe it's from your days with the Scorpions that you got that inquiring mind, not just a legal mind, but something that sort of gets to that golden thread, to the nub of what's happening.
I don't know if it's the Scorpions or just the years of litigating. You know, as a prosecutor, you spend 5 hours a day in court, 5 days a week. And I did that for the better part of nearly 10 years. And when you do that, and when you get dockets in from cops, you have to be able to look at it and you have to be able to see, this is where I'm going to lose the case. This is what I need to plug up the holes. And so I suppose if you turn that on its head for what I'm doing now, that's where the other party is going to lose the case, because they didn't plug up the hole. So that's the thread I have to pull. So it's a bit like a puzzle. It's a bit like a chess game. The art of war.
Yeah. Well, there's the author, you might know the author, Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote a couple of books. In fact, I think Bernard's 8 books. Well, I might be wrong, but I've read 8 books of his. And he, in one of his books, calls it the practice of 10,000 hours makes you an expert. Mm-hmm. And this is probably what's happened to you, because you've probably spent the 10,000 hours in your lifetime. I'm not dating you, don't worry.
Probably more than that.
But probably more than that, and that makes you an expert. In other words, it was Gary Player who said, the more practice, the luckier I get. And I'm finding that with you looking at a file and somehow a fresh pair of eyes, where I'm treading down a pathway thinking this is going to be a long trial, there's going to be 20 witnesses, I'm going to need a week in the CCMA, and you come, look at it, and say, well, hold on, we need about 2 hours at the CCMA. It's not going to be an issue over here. And you find that. So the 10,000-hour rule, he referred to the Beatles as well, because they used to go every weekend and play in Germany nonstop until they'd done their 10,000 hours, and then they became quite a good band. They did really well. So is that what you're feeling, that you've had that practice? You look at it far with jaundiced eyes.
It's funny that the 10,000-hour rule, I first encountered in music as well. It's quite interesting, I must say. But I think the experience helps, because when I look at a case, I don't look at what have we got and what do we have to do. I look at what do I want out of this. And if you know what you want out of it and you work backwards, then it's sometimes easier to find a path to get there. And yes, you're right, it's experience. It's the 10,000 or 20,000 hours that I've spent doing it that I think makes it achievable.
Okay, and you've also got a lot of practice under your belt through the various bargaining councils, which gets you to understand how industry works. I don't know, maybe mention one or two of the bargaining councils that you've dealt with, and then you've learned a little bit about that industry and get... I mean, for instance, the Building Industry Bargaining Council, you know, I've appeared there quite often, and somehow I know from my clients how their businesses work, how systems work. Can you comment on that?
It's true, because unless you understand the industry, then you're going to drop a ball somewhere along the line. So I do work at building industry, metal engineering, road transport, actually all of them, private security. And each one, while the rules appear on the face of it to be similar, there are dynamics within the different industries which are very specific. And I always used to say that I've learned more about business practicing law than anything else, because every time you deal with a case, you have to dig into that particular client's business and understand how their business run, understand their industry. So actually, it's really fascinating and useful to be able to do that.
We're going to have a little 1 minute break.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Hi, you're with Michael Bagram every Tuesday morning between 10 and 11. I thank you for tuning in. We have a wonderful guest. It's been an interesting discussion with Advocate Lynette Myberg, who has come through the various courts, the prosecution, etc. And we're talking about her involvement in the labor law at both the CCMA and all the bargaining councils. And she's been explaining to us how the system works and her background and how she actually got beyond that 10,000 hours and become an expert in the labor law in South Africa. But I want to change tack slightly, if you don't mind, Lynette. I want to look at your work doing outreach. I know that you've been involved very heavily with the Reform Shul in Wynberg. I know that you sat on their committee for a few years. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I still do. So Temple Israel has got three centers. I chair the council at Wynberg. I also sit on the board for Temple Israel. And the three centers are Greenpoint and Wynberg and West Coast, which is in Milnerton. So yes, I'm still very much involved in that.
Okay, and you've also done some work, from what I understand, as the chairperson of the Foundation for Community Work. What is that? And are you still involved in that?
Yes, and I've been involved in that probably for, I want to say 15 years, maybe 20 years, I don't know. It is an NGO that focuses on early childhood education. So the outreach goes to very young children in areas that are very poor, where there's no access to preschools, to try and get young children ready for school so that when they actually get into grade R and into grade one, they can navigate the system and progress as they should. It's a wonderful organization. It does fantastic work. And I'm quite proud of the achievements of the staff at FCW.
And you also, from what I see in your CV, with another organization called Dance for All. What is that?
It's something very similar. It is an organization that I think it started out with ballet. I've not been involved there quite as long, only a few years. What they do is teach all forms of dance to young people that go out into schools, and they also have a studio in Athlone where kids come if they can. And they've had great success. Quite a few of their graduates have become professional dancers. They struggle immensely because there is not much funding for the arts at the moment. So it's an absolute uphill battle for them, but I think they do fantastic work. And a civilization without art and culture must crash, which is why I do what I can to support them as well. I think they do fantastic work.
Well, thank you. I'm going to wrap up, so I really appreciate you spending your time with us today. I appreciate you sharing your innermost thoughts with us and the public. So thank you very much.
Thank
I
you.
wish you well in the future of the ongoing labor law career. I look forward to working with you. But I also thank you for the outreach work that you are doing, both for the Temple Israel and for disadvantaged communities. I know that's your passion. So thank you very much, and thanks for being with us today, and over to Chai FM.